Hey there. Are you tired of waiting for the next episode of It's Probably Not Aliens? Well, we've got some good news for you. On Nebula, our streaming service, you can get access to all our episodes a week early. That's right. You'll never have to wait again to hear Scott and I debunk the latest ancient astronaut theory or get a movie fact wrong. But that's not all. Nebula is home to dozens of content creators we know you like, so you can find all your favorites in one place. Plus, we post content on there that you won't find anywhere else. And the best part? By signing up for Nebula at nebula.tv/probablynotaliens, you're directly supporting the show and both of us. So don't wait any longer. Join Nebula today and listen to the next episode right after this one.
Hi, Tristan, you're going to talk to me about a TV show.
I'm going to talk to you about the best TV show currently on television right now.
I would say arguably we talk about the best TV show currently on air every single week, which is Ancient Aliens.
No.
But this is a better one, is what you're saying?
I have three of my top five TV shows have the same guy involved with it. I would almost say four because one, he wrote for a bunch.
All right. Who is this guy?
Have you ever heard of Ron D. Moore?
Ron D. Moore. I don't think so.
In some ways, he is like almost responsible for the serialization of television in like the 2000s.
Okay.
So here's the things that he's known for. One, he was a huge contributor to Star Trek. Just huge.
All right. Off to a good start.
Next Generation and Deep Space Nine specifically. The best ones.
The best ones.
The ones he was most involved with, though, was Deep Space Nine, where he was the supervising producer and a co-executive producer and was like on the production staff. And so was like had a really big role in the structure of the show and gave it like its serialized character-driven nature that basically made the show one of the best. Deep Space Nine is the best TV show that has ever been made by human beings. It is the peak of television that we have never gotten close to.
And I promise one day I will watch it.
Yeah. The next thing he then went on to do was the Battlestar Galactica reboot of the early 2000s, which was
a bit of a theme here with this guy. A lot of sci-fi, a lot of space travel.
Yeah. Ron D. Moore then made Outlander.
I know Outlander, right? Is that the one I know?
Maybe.
I don't know Highlander.
Was that that incredibly horny show that you got me to watch one time?
I believe so. I don't know why I'm second guessing myself. I've seen all of it. I'm pretty sure it's Outlander. I just get confused because there's so many Landers out there. Outlander, yeah, with the lady doctor who goes back in time. She's a surgeon. She's a surgeon who goes back in time somehow magically and has all this knowledge of First World War medicine, and which is, you know, obviously not as advanced as today, but it is very advanced for 100 years ago when she travels back in time.
Which is odd because the First World War is 100 years ago now. So,
well, it is 100 years ago now, but she goes back even further, 100 more years back in time.
Okay.
And travels back to, you know, into Scotland and things like that, and meets a sexy redhead named Jamie, and they have sex, and it's good stuff.
I remember trying to get into it, and it was an extremely horny show.
Oh yeah, it's horny. It stopped being. This is the thing. Like, we can't go down this.
That's
rabbit
what it
hole.
Lost its it track. It stopped being horny.
It stopped being horny, and it started being like historical drama and intrigue, which is like fine, but that's not why people watched it. I don't think.
Okay.
It's still going. It's still going. I'm still watching it. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Ron D. Moore's latest show is possibly, it is a mix of a bunch of things that are things that I have like been consistently disappointed with, a genre that I've been consistently disappointed with in speculative fiction. And honestly, like a kind of a show that we need as a species right now. So his latest show, which just wrapped up its fourth season, is called For All Mankind.
I know of this one. I have not seen this one, but you're saying it is the best show airing right now.
Yes, which it's the best show airing on right now that no one's talking about. So obviously it's on Apple TV.
It's on Apple TV, which means you get to watch it in those fancy new Apple Vision Pro goggles. $3,500. Oh my God, yeah. Watch a TV show.
Watch a TV show while driving your car or riding watch an electric show. Skateboard down middle of God. You know, there was this like...
Everyone's just doing that for content and clout. No one is actually doing that.
Okay, but there was this...
No one is actually doing it. They're doing it so we talk about them, which is what we're doing.
Are you trying to will that into existence?
No, I'm not trying to will it into existence. I'm saying no one is actually doing the things that you've seen them do. People are at home watching Avatar Way of the Water. That's all they're doing in it, realistically.
Okay. Just because, like, with people who really like Apple, they sometimes like to, like, make a really big deal of showing off that they have enough money for Apple products. And sometimes when Apple products look stupid, it means that they make a really big deal of showing off this stupid thing they have. And
they show it. Yeah, for clout. That's what I'm saying. No one's actually going to like there are so many clips I've seen of like people going to like McDonald's wearing it and like eating a burger wearing it. It's like no one is actually doing it though. They're just doing it to make videos about them. But no one's actually doing it.
What that does remind me of is that this was maybe like 15 years ago. Do you remember Google Glass?
Oh yeah.
So there was a guy who took his Google Glass into a McDonald's where like the people were kind of uncomfortable because it looked like they were being filmed because they probably were. Mm-hmm. And so they asked him to leave. And he basically pivoted this as like, this is the first anti-cyborg discrimination, like hate crime that has ever happened. Uh-huh. And it was like, one of the funnier... The people who were into Google Glass were a unique breed of human. But okay, For All Mankind.
For All Mankind.
So For All
Mankind. Watch it on Apple Vision Pro. Yep.
Yeah. So For All Mankind is a entry into a genre that I have been consistently disappointed with forever, which is alternate history.
Yeah.
Alternate history is a really cool concept for a genre of speculative fiction where, you know, history is different. And then you kind of deal like something different happened in the past and you see what that world looks like. The biggest show probably being The Man in the High Castle. The problem with it is that the genre is, I think, annoying because it's filled with people who have cool concepts for settings, but then forget that stories have to happen in settings.
Okay.
Like they wanted to make a Wikipedia article or like a D&D setting book, but they had to then make a novel. And so like one of the most heinous ones is Harry Turtledove, who has this series where aliens invade during World War II, and it has something like 40 POV characters. And so the first like 150 pages happen and literally nothing's happened yet because he's too busy introducing like two dozen characters into this thing.
Yeah.
Because he needs to see he needs to have the setting that he wants to actually talk about be seen from all these different angles.
I feel like Bright is an example of this in a fantasy instead of sci-fi thing. You remember Bright when that was a big thing?
That was that like Will Smith cop movie with like orcs and stuff.
Yeah, it was like what if the real world and fantasy world merged over. Lindsay Ellis made a video about it like ages ago and was like, it doesn't work for like historical fiction or like alternate history fiction because there are so many different place, like real life places like LA or whatever, that is like, okay, but the history of why LA is called LA also meant that history needed to happen, and like all these references that they make, and it's like, how could all of this happen and also there's fantasy creatures? So it's like nothing else happened.
There's a bit of like, this is me kind of like toppling the Holy Grail here, but like it's kind of why I don't really like the X-Men as a stand-in for discrimination, because it was always a stand-in for like racism. But like if people based on their skin color had like apocalyptic levels of superpowers, you might be like if there were people like 1 in 10 million people were born with like the ability to shoot lasers out of their eyes that could knock down buildings, I might also be on board for some registration.
But and we can't get into this because we haven't even started the real podcast yet. But Cyclops doesn't want to shoot lasers out of his eyeballs. That's a disability.
Sure.
He's not actually trying to do anything harmful.
I 100% understand. But if you can do that, it might behoove people to be aware of that. say, oh no, my glasses broke. Like for most people, that's like, okay, here's your glasses.
I can't drive home because my vision isn't good enough.
But if you're Scott,
if you're me,
if you're Scott, I can't remember what his last name is. Scott
Summers.
Scott Summers. That means that, like, if you open your eyes, you will destroy an entire city block. And I think, I don't know. There's a lot to that. Anyways, this is tangents within tangents.
I know. So, we are so far off track.
Yeah. But For All Mankind is a show where in 1969, Apollo 11 gets scooped by the Soviet Union. That is like the inciting historical difference. So the Soviet Union beats America to the moon, and mm-hmm. Richard Nixon, not to be one-upped by the commies, decides mm-hmm. to make a, he declares that America is going to have the first moon base.
Mm.
And the show takes place over multiple decades with differing degrees of how good they are at making up people to, like, you know, people who are in their 40s who are now playing people in their 70s. But mm-hmm. like, basically the space race continues after 1969 and gets even more intense. And like, by the most recent season, they're like, it's like 2003 and they're on Mars.
Mm.
And there's like alternate history stuff going on throughout the entire show. Like, different events happen, things play out differently. Some of the similar events happen. It's really good. And it's the first time, because like, many alternate history stories are very much like, there's it's always so lazy, because it's almost always like, what if the Nazis won World War II? Or what if the Confederates won the Civil War? And this was the first one I saw that was like, hey, what if things were better than the one that we have now? Like, what if we had a good alternate history?
Yeah.
And where like, we figured out fusion in like the 1990s, and like all of the like Arabian oil tycoons are like struggling to stay afloat because the whole thing that's keeping their oppressive regimes afloat isn't working anymore, and like all that kind of stuff. Like, it's and you know, communism is still a viable political movement in the 2000s. You know, positive, good things.
yeah.
It does fall a little bit for like Soviets, like Russia bad, which I think like Russia bad, Soviets are bad. They're unequivocally bad because communists and communists are bad.
It is a TV show made by an American trillion-dollar company.
Yeah.
So,
but besides that though, like, it's like one of the best shows for like, you know, having a sort of hopeful vision of humanity. And the sort of general theme that runs through every season is that when we fall down to our like small bickering nationalisms or our like, you know, our personal greed, we fall short. And when we do great things that are designed for like the benefit of all humankind, it's when we like rise to those occasions. Yeah. When we like rise to the occasion and do things for the betterment of everybody, we can do great things. And that's like the sort of theme that runs the show. And it's amazing. And if you haven't watched it yet, you just do it. Do it now. You signed up for Apple TV so you could watch Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso's done.
It's done now.
Mm-hmm. You still have a few months until Severance season 2 happens.
Severance comes out. That's, we're hanging on for Severance.
I think Severance got pushed back quite a bit because of the strike. But,
another great that one is definitely more anti-capitalist, which I do enjoy. Yeah.
But one of the things, this is like the, hopefully, like, I don't want to spoil too much of the show, but this is something that kind of happens in like the first handful of episodes and like the sort of political fallout of losing the space race. But one of the things that happens that is one of the greatest unacknowledged, or one of like the things that should have happened in history but never did, happens surrounding a person that is going to be the main focus of this episode today. So actually, there is a point to this whole conversation.
There's a point. We're like 15, 16 minutes in, and there is a point to us talking about
this. So this is a podcast called It's Probably Not Aliens.
Woo!
Where we talk,
we did it.
Yeah, where we talk about ancient astronaut theory, ancient aliens, pseudo-history, pseudo-archaeology, pseudoscience, conspiracy theories, all with sort of a sci-fi bent.
Yes. My name is Scott Nicewander. I know nothing. I haven't even watched For All Mankind. I'm waiting for All Womankind to come out because I am an ally.
Wow.
Unlike Tristan, who clearly isn't. The only thing that I know is that I'm going to push back against the mutant thing again, because think about how many people have illnesses that get discriminated against in jobs and in careers and things like that because they have to tell people that they have certain illnesses, and Cyclops has a disability that would prevent him from getting jobs. There's just discrimination all over, Tristan. I understand them wanting to hide it is all I'm saying.
My name is Tristan Johnson, and I acknowledge that if you can kill somebody by making skin on skin contact with them, that goes outside the normal bounds of disability.
Just wear gloves then.
Either way, this is a pod. So we are sort of three episodes deep into ancient aliens and the, or aliens and the Third Reich, this absolutely bomb. bonkers episode of Ancient Aliens that has so much shit in it. The main thing that we're going to be doing today, though, and I think this is going to have to become more the norm as we go through this episode, is that this episode has a much more clear thing it's trying to say, and then it spins off in a bunch of directions based on I'll start with this. Like, basically, we've already established in the last couple episodes that Ancient Aliens is saying that the Nazis had alien technology, or that they just had super technology. And because that's established, we then go into various different aspects of Nazi science and such, and be like, and that's how you know that aliens were involved with this. So last week we did their Adam Waffen program. The week before we did Victor Schauberger's anti-gravity thing. One of the other claims that they make is that the breakthrough V1 and V2 rocket program were far ahead of their time, and that they were reverse engineering crashed alien spacecraft when they developed the first cruise missile and the first ballistic missile.
Shocking.
So, and that when Operation Paperclip happened, that was the Americans taking all of the ancient alien technology that the Germans had and bringing it to Area 51 so that they could do their own sort of research on it.
Just a quick one there. Yeah.
So today we're talking, though, specifically about the V1 and V2 rockets. That's the general gist of what happened. And I feel like the next few episodes is going to be, or a lot of these episodes are going to be like, because we know that the Nazis were reverse engineering alien tech, or they just had sci-fi super tech, therefore this. And we'll
the word no is in heavy quotes.
Yeah, exactly. So the general claim today is that the V1 and V2 rocket programs represented technological advancements that were influenced by extraterrestrial technology. That's the gist.
That's it.
So let's talk a little bit about this stuff.
It's another one there.
Yeah. The V1 and V2 rockets developed by Nazi Germany during World War II were part of a long-range artillery program known as the Vergeltungswaffen, or retaliatory weapons. We'll get more into the V1 and V2 rocketry programs, but they were huge technological advances that increased the maximum range of what you could do. If you think about this before this, the most that you could do was fire artillery shells, which is just firing a shell out of a cannon and having it explode. The V1 was the first cruise missile, which is a propelled rocket that had a missile on board. Mm. And the V2 rocket increased the range and also developed a guidance system. So it was the first missile that you could actually adjust its trajectory while flying.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And one of the key figures for developing the V2 rocket was a physicist/scientist named Wernher von Braun.
I've heard this name before.
Yeah, he's our main character today.
He's the main character of Twitter today.
Yeah, he's Bean Dad, but for rockets.
Gosh, that's old.
What sucks is that one of my favorite songs was made by Bean Dad, and I feel bad every time I listen to it.
Stop listening to it.
But it's so good.
Nope, it's done. It's ruined by beans.
Okay. But this is not a really good one to go on. The general bit that you can say about this, and this is this is what makes the debunking part of this video this episode not really great, is that the point is that there's no evidence to show this, and it's very obvious that this shit was just made up. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. It's untrue. We have pretty good evidence to show exactly how the V2 rocket program, the V1 rocket program worked. And we know very well that it was done by human engineers because we have all of the evidence, and we have people who literally worked on these programs who described everything they did.
Pretty strong evidence then.
Yeah, the biggest one being is that after World War II, the Americans took a whole bunch of that technology and just brought it back to use it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they had gotten super sci-fi weapons, they would have used them to do Soviet stuff. Yeah. The main thing to talk about, though, with the V1 and V2 rockets is that the reason they were so impressive and so fast is because they were the result of intense research and development by German scientists and engineers. And they were also built by forced labor under inhumane conditions.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So that's kind
of could have seen that coming.
Mm hmm. So again, this plays into the bigger idea that Nazi Germany had access to alien technology, which is, again, it's an unfact. There's no evidence that it actually happened.
It is kind of fitting that a lot of stuff that ancient aliens and ancient astronaut theory says is alien technology or was made by aliens or something is actually just slaves. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just slave labor. How did they do it? How did they move the big rocks? How did they build the pyramids? How did they make the rockets? It's just slave labor, bud. That's it.
I'm actually reading this really great book right now called Humankind that talks a lot about how things like the Moai statues and like a lot of these like Göbekli Tepe and stuff like that were probably made because before farming, people had so much free time that moving big rocks was just sort of like a thing that you could do to structure your day. Like a kind of just a thing to keep you busy because you had so much free time to just chill. Because humans are designed to forage for a little bit and then chill for most of the day.
Yeah. Just, hey, there's a rock over here. You want to move it over there? Yeah, I got nothing going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, like if you have like humans are have like a sort of biological need to create things. And so if we're just like hanging around doing nothing, then we start like, hey, what if I made this rock look like a face? Well, let's stand it up. All right. And then like you can see how that accelerates.
Oh, yeah. We don't have that anymore. Everyone's locked into their Apple Vision Pros.
Yeah, on their skateboard.
On their skateboard at McDonald's.
Okay, I will say, if they're just doing it for clout or whatever, I always just am reminded that I'm like, Casey Neistat just...
You don't have to say any more than that. I'm with you immediately.
He's an extremely exhausting human being.
Yeah.
He is the perfect sign that being rich, like there's this whole, like, you know, there's this sort of liberal fantasy that rich people are rich because they're the most innovative and intelligent and most like perfect people.
Yeah, they got through the meritocracy.
Yeah. And Casey Neistat is a repudiation of that. I knew that from the moment he made an entire video talking about how much he loved the Juicero.
Oh my God.
I just want to know how much money he lost on NFTs. Because it's a lot. I don't know how much it is, but I know it's a lot.
I mean, you still had enough to buy a $3,500 headset. So must be doing okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the thing about this whole idea of Nazis having UFOs got popularized through a bunch of books and documentaries like Third Reich, Hitler's UFOs, Whoa. And the Nazis' most powerful weapon, or Saucers Whoa. Of Fear, Nazi UFOs, Alien Abduction, Project Bluebeam, which we definitely need to make a video about some, or an episode about at some point, or
sure.
high-tech horrors from the X-Files of Saucerian Press. What a book title.
What a book title.
The Nazi UFOs, where are they now? Good question.
Good question. No way. You're on the right track. Yeah. Keep following that thought.
Exactly. In Search of Aliens, World War II, time travel warfare.
Oh,
they couldn't
gosh.
Time travel to realize that fascism is a loser ideology, but okay. Unidentified fascist objects, which admittedly, great title for an article.
Holy shit, what a good title.
But that is actually Unidentified Fascist Objects is the article that a lot of this research came from because it is debunking all of this stuff. But it is a sort of study of the
great.
Actual like connection between Holocaust deniers and the Nazi UFO conspiracy. So because it talks about people like Ernst Zundel, who was a prolific Holocaust denier who also got into UFO culture and was one of the propagators of the ideas of Nazi UFOs.
I mean, it's something you've said a lot before on this podcast is like, it's really easy to go from one conspiracy and start believing in others. And I feel like this is a really good example of this sort of Venn diagram sort of crossing over.
Yeah, it's weird how it keeps happening. Anyways, the other sort of side, the ancient alien side, is that sometimes they also have a different sort of spin on it that they didn't get it from a UFO, but they got it by like sending archaeologists to like sites in India and stuff like that. They got the Vimana tech, they got the nuclear tech from like they kind of did that kind of thing. The Nazi UFOs narrative is also built on the fact that the Nazis did have an interest in the occult and that they had these Wunderwaffen or miracle weapons, which was kind of like part moonshot program to try and turn around their fates as they were losing World War II, but also part propaganda effort because kind of get into this later, but fascists sort of have it's a thing I'm getting into in my next YouTube video, but fascists have always had sort of a weird fetishization of technology, which explains why so many of them now have pictures of apes on their Twitter profile pictures.
Oh, I see.
So like the Nazis did have a bunch of stuff that had to do with like fetishizing this technology and thinking that they could, you know, win the war that was based around, you know, just pumping out enough stuff. Like World War II was very much like, how can you get your economy to pump out more tanks, bullets, guns, trucks, people who are trained?
How do you get on that grind set?
Yeah,
World War II was about getting on that grind set, getting on that getting on the killing other people grind set.
Yeah. World War II was very much like, because the technologies were, you know, as soon as you invented something, your enemy would blow up one of them and then reverse engineer it, and they would have, like, you know, counters pretty fast. So World War II very much became, how can you, like, mobilize your entire economy to out-economy the other side's economy?
That's right. Hustle.
Yeah. And it turns out to win that, you just have to have a fully full command economy under a Soviet Stalinist economic order seems to be the most efficient, because you can just...
You gotta attend a long weekend Gary V conference and you'll be inspired.
Joseph Stalin, big fan of Gary V, was put his entire economy on the hustle grind set.
Was like, hustle grind set, I wake up, I have 3 weeks in the span of 1 week. Think about that. Think about that.
His 5-year plans were his 5-year plans and his, like, insane quotas. It was all just trying to get the Soviet Union on that hustle grind set. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is Joey S. here, just trying to motivate you all to...
You're going
to
NFT a house? That was the weirdest thing I've ever heard Gary V. say. I still don't understand it to this day. He was like...
Gary V. doesn't understand it.
He was like, you get a house, NFT it, and then in this many years... I'm like, what do you mean? What does that mean, Gary?
Man, we're going for a very specific kind of person today.
Yeah. Sorry.
Gary Vee is one of those people that I put them on a list of, there's a small list of people I have that involves people like Matt Iglesias, where I will say, there is nobody on earth who is as smart as these people think they are.
That's good.
So yeah, this sort of like the Wunderwaffe program was this idea that they would just solve World War II change through technology and not through economics. Mostly because Germany, as we kind of established in the show last episode, the whole idea about World War II is that Germany was on the economic back foot compared to countries like the Soviet Union and the Allies, who the Allies all had massive colonial empires, and the Soviet Union had hundreds of millions of people and just like
had people. Yeah.
And also, this is one that like Cold War propaganda doesn't really want to give a lot of credit to, but they had an economy where it was fully run by the government. So like if they needed to be like, hey, all of those things that made cans for food, they all need to be turned into tank factories, and that's going to happen right now.
Yeah.
Or like if the Germans are going to take our factory, we're going to tear it down brick by brick, put it onto trains, send it to Siberia, rebuild the factory brick by brick. And then like the Soviets had just like this economy where they could do anything. Because it was
like
all...
You just do whatever they needed to do.
Yeah, and that sort of also turned the war around for them pretty impressively. I mean, it was also a brutal dictatorship that the people who had to do all the work to make that stuff happen, it was terrible, and the working conditions were awful.
Let's not sugarcoat it as if
everything
was... I'm
no Stalin
stan here. No.
Stalin's economic planning was good for one specific thing, which was entirely converting the economy for a single purpose. And if that single purpose is defeating fascists, then like it's not the worst thing in the world. The thing though is that the Wunderwaffe program was like, we're just gonna invent cool crazy things,
let's go.
Yeah, despite the effectiveness of these weapons, propaganda talked about them being these huge outstanding groundbreaking technologies that were going to turn the tide of the war any day now, trying to like kind of boost morale in Germany during the end of the war.
Okay.
But a lot of these were impractical or resource intensive or just like too late to actually make a difference.
It's like CES, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's, you've got all these companies coming out being like, this is the new technology we've got in the future. And it's like really wild stuff that's either like trickery and doesn't actually work the way it is, or it's like way too expensive that no one could ever actually buy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I feel like it is. Like, it is CES.
That's not too far off, actually. So but the thing is, though, if you are, say, a person who maybe is enticed by Nazi ideas after World War II, a neo-Nazi, if you will.
Huh, that's a good... Did you just coin that one? Yeah. That's pretty good.
If you think that, and then you see all this propaganda from the war, then you might be inclined to think that there's more to it than this. And that's sort of like, in my mind, I think that is like the origin of a lot of these, like, you know, Nazis had super weapons type thinking. I just want to give you a couple ideas, I wrote down a few examples of these kinds of Wunderwaffen programs. So first was the Schwerer Gustav, the heavy Gustav, an 800 millimeter gun that you would put on a train. So this is the largest artillery piece that had ever been used in warfare. Just a massive gun that required an logistics effort to just assemble it and move it. But it was a artillery gun so big that you had to mount it on a train.
Bigger gun. That's how you win war. Bigger gun.
Yeah. The other one would be the V3 cannon, otherwise known as the Wachtrumpumpe, which was this multi-stage, super long-range cannon. This is the one we talked about that used coordinated explosions to fire shells across the English Channel to land them into London. They were going to build these in the Pas-de-Calais region, but they never actually got one up and running.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Kumlauf, which was this barrel attachment for the Sturmgewehr 44 assault rifle that would allow it to shoot around corners.
Whoa.
Yeah, they built one of these, but it had an extremely short barrel life and was just completely impractical for using it in a lot of things. Which means that, firing it a few times, it would wear itself out. They then invented the Panhandrum, which was this rocket-propelled explosive wheel that would go over, one of the other sort of defensive technologies were, people building, concrete walls. So this would be, a rocket-propelled wheel that would, roll over the walls and explode.
This is, Junkrat's tire from Overwatch?
Basically, yeah. that's exactly, yeah.
That's funny.
Somebody needs to investigate Junkrat.
Actually, I have some follow-up questions for Junkrat.
The problem is that it was, like Junkrat, unreliable and uncontrollable. And that's why friends don't let friends play Junkrat. Anyways.
That's right.
There was also the Dreiflügeljäger, which was an attempt to make a vertical takeoff and landing interceptor with rotating wings, which, as we already know about vertical taking off and landing interceptors,
it's hard to do.
Yeah. They're still working on that one. No, we can't Osprey post anymore.
All we can say is it's just hard to do.
It's hard to do.
I feel like that's fair.
The Osprey does exist. Its safety record is something. There was also the Ruhrstahl X-4, which was a wire-guided air-to-air missile. So it was an air-to-air missile, like a missile that would fire from a plane to hit other planes.
Oh.
But it was, this one might have actually worked, but it began production in 1945 and the Germans didn't last long enough for it to come into full production. Yeah.
A little late on that one.
There was the Panzer VIII Maus, which was a super heavy tank. This is the one where they were trying to make tanks out of naval parts. Too heavy and impractical for actual combat. They made two prototypes that never actually saw combat.
Mm-hmm.
There was the ME-163 Comet, which was a rocket-powered interceptor. But so you want to know something that sounds absolutely insane. It's the ME-163 Comet.
Yes.
This was an attempt to build a rocket plane.
A rocket plane!
So they're like, let's take this V2 rocket technology and apply it to airplane.
Let's go!
You'll be surprised to know that the Comet was, quote, difficult to fly. And also dangerous to its own pilots due to volatile fuel. Maybe strapping people onto a missile, not viable. Well, I guess that's basically what rockets are today, but
that's rockets.
Yeah. Then there was the ME-262 Schwalbe, which was the world's first jet aircraft, but it had a lot of delays and its deployment came out too late and it was too unreliable to actually work in the field. So it didn't actually do very well.
Fair enough.
All of these, lots of German weapons productions, especially ones on the Wunderwaffe program, also relied heavily. Again, I'm going to reply on forced slave labor, because a lot of this technological advancements happened on the exploitation of the suffering of countless individuals.
Yep.
The other part that also brings people into this is the idea that Nazis were into the occult, which some segments of the Nazi party actually did have an interest in, with people like Heinrich Himmler, who had this weird interest in Germanic myths. The thing, though, is that this has been one of the most overstated things and has been really played with in pop culture, with everything from, Captain America to Hellboy to
I was thinking Hellboy.
It's become such a big thing in pop culture that it's been like grotesquely overstated. And the idea that like these sort of myths that some high ranking Nazi officials had like a side interest in, that it had any role in like actual decision making or like Nazi ideology, is not very strong.
Just a little too fabricated.
Yeah.
It's just a nice story that people say. I guess not really a nice story.
It's one of those things that we can use to otherize or to sort of to talk about the Nazis as if they had some sort of like evil or alien process to distance the fact that their beliefs were extreme versions of ones that are still prevalent today. You know, that their main ideology was nationalism, racism, and the sort of drive to create colonial spaces, which were all things that Western countries also did. The Germans just did it harder.
So we have to sort of say like, yeah, but also there was this guy that was really obsessed with these like ridiculous myths and you know, things like that. And we don't do that part.
Yeah. And that like they weren't Christian. They were into like ancient Teutonic myths. And we'll just not talk about how quiet the Pope was and how much he might have known about the Holocaust and didn't say or do anything about it.
I'm learning a lot about popes this week for a video that I'm doing.
Interesting.
We'll get into that. We'll get into that at the end when I promote my next video.
Sweet. So that's the other thing. A lot of times also that we found that there's a lot of like, you know, images that come out from the Nazi regime are like photoshopped or fictional stories like that came out like way later. Like a lot of books that came out in the 90s when like the UFO renaissance happened through like the X-Files.
Of course.
And you know, if there's two things that people are fascinated by, it's UFOs and Nazis. So obviously someone was going to slap the two together to make a quick buck off of some books.
Peanut butter and chocolate, put it together. They're better together.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically like putting to rest the idea that the V1 and V2 rockets were supernatural technology. But I do want to talk about the actual V1 and V2 rocket program.
I would love to learn about real history on this show. I feel like we don't do that enough. We only do it once a week and it's time again. So I would love to learn about the real history of these things, if you could.
Well, first.
Yeah.
Product?
Yeah, or service. Either one.
Good product.
Yummy, tasty,
yeah,
delicious. I ate it.
Sign up for micromodal underwear that you can eat.
Keto
underwear.
Sign up for keto underwear. Sign up to have a fresh keto underwear delivered to your door or email.
Four keto underwear boxes come to your four meals.
Come to your email.
Come to your email every
come
day.
Come to your email every day. That's our new product or service.
And also it's a mattress. You can sleep on it.
That's great.
Okay, rockets.
Rockets.
Everyone loves them. They do all sorts of cool things. And you know what? The idea that the V1 and V2 rocket programs were like the invention of them is actually a bit of a misnomer because they have been around for a long ass time.
But V1 has the number one in its name. It's got to be the first one.
Well, it turns out that rockets actually, like all technology, evolve in a context.
You know how I feel about context.
Yeah, I have a t-shirt that explains it.
Yeah, love it. Can't get enough.
So the first rockets that I could find actually being used are from the 10th century, which would be the
1100s. So that's a little earlier than World War II.
Yeah.
So how did that work?
So the first rockets, or the first things that we could call rockets, were found in the Song Dynasty period in China. And what they would do is they would attach like propulsion systems onto arrows.
Make them fly farther.
Yeah, basically. Although there's solid documentary evidence show it, like the evidence of rockets existing doesn't show up until the 13th century, but like writings in the 13th century say that in the 10th century they were using. So there might be a bit of like a mythological thing going on, but sometime in the 10th to 13th century they were using rockets as like a way to accelerate arrows in China.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Further, faster, harder, explodier.
We need some French robots here to turn that into a song.
Yeah. Further, faster.
They broke
harder,
up, didn't
better,
they?
Better, stronger. A while back, I feel.
Yeah.
But we can get them back together for this one.
So Europe didn't seem to find the rocket until the 16th century when an Austrian by the name of Konrad Huss wrote a treatise on rocketry, including ideas for crude rockets. Yeah.
All right. Rockets that are a little blue collar. They'll say what they're thinking.
Yeah. But you imagine like, man, I want like, what would you even call this? Like enlightenment punk of like a thing where like Austrians figured out how to make like rockets and go to space in like the 1600s. That would fucking rule.
Or
the 1500s.
Yeah.
Another example in Europe would be in the 17th century. In for the history nerd, one of our favorite weird countries that doesn't exist anymore, which was the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Oh, yeah. First time hearing of this.
If you are a nerd, especially a Paradox Interactive nerd, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth is like a bit of a meme. But the Polish-Lithuanian general from there named, and I apologize for this extremely Polish name that I'm going to read, Kazimierz Semenowicz, who published a book called The Complete Art of Artillery, which also had a bunch of stuff in it that increased and advanced rocket tech.
Oh, well, you can't spell artillery without art. Or ill, because it's sick, dude.
It's ill.
This artillery is sick.
This is art and it's ill.
Yeah, it is.
It's the most 90s thing ever. The principle behind rockets was outlined in something called the rocket equation, which was pioneered by a Russian scientist by the name of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. That's it. Who published the equation in 1903, which basically was the beginning of modern rocket science. The sort of physics that you need to understand the relationship between mass, speed, and the speed of what is basically how a rocket works, which is that it's about gas being shot at high pressure out of the back of an object to give it thrust.
Do you think that this was all created because our boy Constantine, someone was like, how do you think this works? And he goes, I don't know, I'm no rocket scientist, but I could be.
This guy's the ultimate rocket scientist because he basically invented rocket science.
He is the one.
He met the first brain surgeon and was like, that guy thinks he's so smart. I'm going to invent something.
I could also be a smart person, an analog for a smart person.
Yeah. There's a really great skit from Mitchell and Webb where two people, like, they're at a party and there's two, like, this guy's like showing off that he is a brain surgeon and like shows how he's smarter than everyone else. And then he runs into another guy at the party who is a rocket scientist. And the two of them sort of like try to out-asshole each other about like browbeating about how smart they are. It's a great skit.
It's pretty good.
But basically, like, this stuff is all about like Konstantin Tsiolkovsky's work was about like the math, about how much mass and speed and propellant you would need to like if you needed to get a rocket this many feet in the air that weighed, that sent this much of a payload up, you would need this much fuel coming out at this much speed. And like that sort of math is still key to like how we get things to space today, right? Because that's why things cost like $10,000 a kilogram to get into space, because to send one kilogram of mass into space, you need like X amount of kilograms of fuel to shoot the rocket into space with it on it.
And then that fuel needs to make up for its own weight and like
Exactly.
It just keeps adding on to itself.
Yeah, that's why, like, if you ever hear about like in science fiction when people talk about things like space elevators, or even like some thoughts about like making a giant Gauss cannon that would use magnets to fire things into space.
Yeah.
The whole concept
is... So you don't have to use fuel.
Yeah, because this is the number one thing stopping us from going into space and going to space all the time, is that the gravity well is prohibitively hard to do things with. So
yeah,
that's the big part. Then the first, like, you know, big, or one of the biggest successful flights with a liquid-propelled rocket came at only in the 20th century with a guy named Robert Goddard, who is an American.
Wait, from Jimmy Neutron?
Maybe that's probably where the Jimmy Neutron got the name.
Goddard. Bark, bark. That's what he says. Did this one also just bark? Was this one a dog as well?
Could be. Jimmy Neutron wouldn't name a dog after a person now, would he?
No. Maybe.
Jimmy Neutron's one of those things that is like, it separates me from like a very, like, there's a cutoff, because Jimmy Neutron was one of like the first cartoons that was a little bit too young for me.
I was worried when I said it that you wouldn't know what I was talking about.
I know of Jimmy Neutron. I just know that Jimmy Neutron was like, that's what like the sort of 10 and 12 year olds were watching when I was like 13, 14, you know?
Gotcha.
Just like how, like, I think the same thing, like there's also the stuff that, you know, like the older kids were watching that were a little bit too old for you. Like for me, it was like the OG Transformers and Ninja Turtles.
Mm.
And mine was like, you know, Beast Wars and some weird YTV show where really poorly 3D animated planets that represent represented the different elements fought each other over a death planet that ate other planets. It was a good show. I don't remember anything about it. I mean, it was probably an awful show because it was made for like 8-year-old boys, but who trying to sell toys. But you know, it was trying to sell, if I remember correctly, it was trying to sell basically Polly Pocket, but this one's for the boys.
This one's for the boys.
Yeah.
This one's Wally Wallet.
Yeah. And this is a planet that eats other planets.
Yeah.
And I remember because it was a planet that ate other planets, but the planet eater like literally had like a big like a claw, like from like a claw machine that would come out and grab the planet and take it inside to eat it.
Oh my god. Yeah,
it was ridiculous. It was definitely like a toy commercial first and an attempt
all
at a show.
All cartoons are toy commercials first.
Especially in the 80s and 90s, I think.
All right, back to Goddard.
Okay, so Goddard made a liquid, a fuel out of liquid oxygen and gasoline, which is honestly pretty interesting because that's not too far off from what rocket fuel is today. Like the rocket fuel that goes into the rockets that go into space today is primarily liquid oxygen and kerosene. You ever notice that like when you see a rocket going off, there are just tons of like mist and steam on the fuel tanks? It's because they're full of liquid oxygen, which is extremely cold.
Oh, I thought it was just to make it look cool.
I mean, it does that too. But like, that's the reason why that stuff is like those fuel tanks are freezing, because to have oxygen be cold enough to be liquid is a very low temperature.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So that is like the state of what rocketry was when we get into World War II. And during World War II, Germany then tried to use rockets to build flying bombs, was basically their idea. They started with the V1, which was called the flying bomb, which was developed at Premenud Army Research Base in 1939 and was the first operational cruise missile. It used a pulse jet engine, which gave it this distinctive buzzing sound. So sometimes it got nicknames among the Allies with like the buzz bomb.
Ooh, buzz bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have buzz balls up in Canada?
No, they're like spherical pop bottles. Or something like that, right? Or no, they're full, they're booze, right?
They're full of alcohol.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah, I think I've seen them.
They will fuck you up.
Sometimes
yeah.
when I go to, because my wife is an American immigrant, and sometimes when we go to her family for Christmas, I think I see them in the liquor store.
Mm, yeah.
Also, just liquor stores are an interesting phenomenon, because here they're all run by the government. So like they're all like pristine, clean, unionized, fancy places. And like liquor stores there are kind of sketchy sometimes.
Sometimes. Depends on where you go.
Indiana.
Well, there you go.
The V1 was about 25 feet long, had a wingspan about 17 feet long, and it carried a 850 kilogram or 1,870 pound warhead. And they would launch them off of a ramp using a steam catapult. Or a modified Henkel Hay 111 aircraft. And its guidance system used a gyroscope, which is one of the coolest inventions ever, and had an autopilot that tried to keep it at a predetermined altitude and speed with a range of about 240 kilometers, but it got increased to 400 kilometers later. So you can imagine in war before this, all you had was what you could fire out of an artillery shell. Now, that could still go very far. And if you knew the math on how to angle things correctly, you could still get pretty far. But being able to fire a missile that can go 240 kilometers was insane.
Well, that's what I imagine. That's why they built the big gun, the big rail gun.
Yeah, that was them attempting to assault to do it without having to make expensive rockets, basically, right?
Yeah. Big gun.
Big gun.
Big gun shoot far.
Big gun does shoot far. That's the Gauss thing to get things into space is basically.
Yeah, big guns shoot real far.
If you think about it, the Gauss gun is basically them trying to do the exact same thing the Nazis did when they were trying to solve the same problem. The rockets are too expensive. Let's just make a big gun that shoots things instead.
Shoot people into space, yeah.
Well, the thing with the Gauss guns is that the one thing you wouldn't be able to do is send people into space, because the G-forces involved would basically turn them into silly putty.
Stop me.
Yeah.
I dare you.
You would just be turned into paste. G-forces are no joke. That's another limitation, is that human beings are very sensitive to G-forces, and you can't go too fast into space or else you will crush everybody inside. The V1 rocket was significant because it was the first use of a guided missile in warfare. It was also relatively inexpensive and quick to produce. It was about the cost of a small car.
Okay.
And it was the beginning of modern missile technology, which I think I think goes without saying today that missiles play a pretty large role in modern warfare.
Yeah.
The first successful V1 flight flight took place on 1942 and was put in production in 1943, and primarily was used to target London and parts of Britain. The first attack happened on June 13th, 1944, but during the war, approximately 9,251 of these V1s were fired, 2,515 reached London and killed about 6,184 civilians with about 17,981 injuries. So this was quite a brutal technology.
Just when you say 9,000 were fired and 2,500 reached London, were they all aimed at London and like 7,000 of them just didn't quite make it there?
I think that might be correct.
Wow. I mean, still devastating the amount of civilian deaths and injuries, but also that's 7,000 missiles that
just crashed in the water.
Are just crashed in the water, I guess.
Or they just like, you know, landed somewhere outside of London.
That's also true.
There's like a whole thing in Europe where they have to like shut down. They have to shut down. Well, there's other parts of Britain too.
Yeah.
A lot of people in London don't know that, but it's true. But like fairly often you'll see a news story where like somebody's like digging in their yard and they accidentally find an unexploded ordnance from one of the world wars. And like they had like bring in bomb disposal people to like remove it.
Yeah.
It happens a lot in Belgium with World War One stuff, but it happens in Britain every so often too.
Wow.
The main things that stopped the V1 is that the Allies started building defenses against it. They would be fighter planes, anti-aircraft batteries, barrage balloons, which I love the idea of barrage balloons so much, you've probably seen these and like, if you're like trying to make World War II Britain look really World War II-y, you'll see these big like balloons floating over the city. And they're supposed to be like balloons that basically deflect bombs and rockets.
So they just like, kind of bounce off. Yeah. Of them. Boom. That's funny.
Yeah. And the V1 rocket program. There's also anti-aircraft guns would basically take down. That's the other part. Some of them wouldn't hit, like 2,515 hit London, but also many of them either missed or were shot down. Anti-aircraft guns or with fighter jets.
Bounced around with those balloons.
Yeah. But basically the threat of V1 rockets only ended when the Allies just overran all of the launch sites near the end of the war.
Oh, that'll do it.
Yeah. So that meant that the Nazis also needed to look into the V2 program, which also was called the A4 program, which was the first operational liquid fuel rocket ballistic missile.
All right.
And this one was
the sequel.
Yeah, this one.
This is the sequel. This is the squeakle.
14 meters long, weighed 12,000 kilograms.
Okay.
Had 725 kilos of explosives or 1,600 pounds. It's guidance.
Big boy.
Yeah. Its guidance system was designed to shut off at a predetermined velocity to start a parabolic free fall towards its target.
Oh, clever.
But it could fly up as high as 50 or 60 miles in the air and could get a speed as high as 3,400 miles per hour, which was a huge advancement for rocket technology and became a huge part of the technology that would lead to the rockets, the ones that we use to go to space.
Space rockets. The ones that are not supposed to explode.
Mm-hmm. Unless Elon Musk is making them.
Even then, they're not supposed to explode.
They just do a lot.
They just do. Look, it was a they're controlled explosions, Tristan. It's supposed to happen on purpose.
Yeah, he meant to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Elon needs more ketamine, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a deep K-hole right now. They produced about 6,000 of these and launched about 2,600 of them to cities like London, Paris, Lille, and Antwerp. They killed about 5,000 people, but these ones were way more expensive. And the other thing, too, is that they were harder to develop and build and were primarily built by prisoners at the Miltenbau Dora concentration camp. And a lot of them people died in the process of manufacturing it. So the main thing I want to get to is that...
Yes.
After World War II, the United States and Soviet Union both captured V2 rockets to reverse engineer them and figure out what was going on and laid the foundation for the space race that would come afterwards. The space race being starting with the launch of the Soviet satellite Sputnik in 1957, which was then followed by Yuri Gagarin, the first man into space, also the Soviets, first woman in space. All right. Also,
that's right, for all womankind.
Just like there's a really funny space race meme, if I can find it. Yeah, I found it here. First artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, Soviet Union. First animal in space, Laika, Soviet Union. First photographs of the far side of the moon, Luna 3, Soviet Union. First person in space, Yuri Gagarin, Soviet Union. First woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, Soviet Union. First spacewalk, Alexei Leonov, Soviet Union. First spacecraft landing on the moon, Luna 9, Soviet Union. First person on the moon, Neil Armstrong, America. First spacecraft landing on another planet, Venus, Venera 7, Soviet Union. First space station, Salyut 1, Soviet Union. First space spacecraft landing on Mars, Mars 3, Soviet Union. Winner of the space race, America.
We put a man on the moon, baby. What did Canada do? What did Canada do, Tristan? Nothing. Oh, you sat wow. by and you watched.
There's literally a children's museum in London that I take my son to every so often that has an entire section where we get way too involved in our space contributions because we made the Canada arm that is like a robotic arm that is attached to the space shuttle and there's one attached to the ISS. And we are so ridiculously proud of it that it's on our money.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
And also the next space launch, that one that's going to the moon, has a Canadian on its crew, and Canadians are losing their shit over the fact that there's going to be a Canadian on the moon. So
there's going to be a Canadian on the moon.
Yeah.
The first person to say, hey.
Hey.
Do you think, and I'm sorry if this is reductive, do you think that the reason Canadians are losing their mind about the first Canadian on the moon is because we're itching to find out what poutine tastes like with moon cheese?
Ooh, good take. That's a better answer than the fact that Canada is kind of a, what we like to call a middle power, but it's basically a kind of not important lapdog of the US. And so whatever little contributions we can actually make to that are of some value to the world, we will latch on to because we need this, okay? Canadian mm-hmm. patriotism has so few things to hang on to that things like the Canada arm is all we have, and like half of the comedians, but that's a different thing.
You've got at least one Avril Lavigne.
Yeah, so the thing though is that the space race has revolutionized defense, commerce, even now tourism a little bit. So like now rockets are highly sophisticated. They can carry people and payloads into space. We're now looking into even reusable rockets when Elon doesn't blow them up. And space exploration has become a lot more sustainable and cost-effective, hopefully to a day where we'll have a whole new space age. But I think that if we're going to, because I want to get into the very complex person behind rocketry who connects the Nazi V2 program and the Apollo program. But I think that we are running a little over time. So part two, we haven't done a part two in a while.
We're going to have to do a part two, but part two seems to be, if this was about the rockets themselves, we need to learn about the man behind the rockets.
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
Yep.
So next week, for you, in like 5 minutes for us as we continue recording, we will talk about
Wernher von Braun.
And that will be our connection to For All Mankind, I imagine. We're back. Full circle.
Yeah. But first, if you like this show and you want to get, you know, pump up the hype for the Von Braun episode, you can go on Twitter or Blue Sky to @ProbsNotAliens. We used to give away Blue Sky codes, but as of like yesterday now, the Blue Sky has been open for everyone.
Come join us. ProbsNotAliens over there and on Twitter if you're using Twitter still, either way. Tristan, where else can people find you on the internet? What do? You're mentioning a video that you've got coming up.
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel called Step Back where I talk about basically why understanding the past is important for getting things as they are, like the world today. If you're listening to this on the day it came out, my latest video is an investigation into how, under the guise of showing support for the people being brutalized and horribly repressed in Palestine, neo-Nazis have been using this horrifying humanitarian crisis to advance anti-Semitic conspiracies and stuff like that. And I kind of talk about media savviness and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Scott.
Yeah.
If I wanted to learn about how She-Hulk broke the fourth wall before Deadpool, where would I pipe comic misconceptions, pipe nerdsing? Where would I go?
You call them pipes? That's interesting.
Where would I go for that?
Yeah, you can. That's my YouTube channel, Nerdsync, NERDSYNC, also on Nebula, if you're a Nebula subscriber over there. I make videos about comics and superheroes and cartoons. I have been teasing forever that I'm making a video about the weird world of cookbooks. I'm putting that one on pause just because it's taking me so long, and I've switched gears right now to talk about The Harlem Globetrotters. What's up with the Harlem Globetrotters? Why are they in Scooby-Doo so much and other Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
Futurama.
Why are they in Futurama? I will maybe briefly touch on Futurama, but specifically Scooby-Doo. What was up with the Harlem Globetrotters? It's fascinating. It's also why I mentioned earlier that I've been learning a lot about popes recently, because there are two honorary Globetrotter members who are popes. But that's my YouTube channel. And like I said, I'm on Nebula. Tristan's on Nebula. This podcast is on Nebula. You can get episodes early, nebula.tv/probablynotaliens. Mm-hmm. Very simple place. And you can leave reviews of this show on Apple Podcasts and feedback on Spotify. I woke up to an email today that said we had 8 people write feedback on Spotify. I love getting those emails.
I need to figure out how your account so I can actually read all the comments on Spotify.
Yeah, Tristan needs to read them. That would be
also validation.
Good. I'll show you the login. So thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for telling your friends about this show. It means a lot to us. And a very simple place to send people is probsnotaliens.com. Mm-hmm. That's the website where it's got links to everything, where every place you can listen to the show. So that is it. And we'll see you in part 2.
Yep.
For a bio episode. We love doing these about Wernher von Braun. But until then, my name is Scott Nicewander.
I'm Tristan Johnson, and the truth is out there. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Probably.
I'll play it right here in the outro. Rocket countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Whoa.
Now we're directed by Chris Nolan.
Yeah.